Funding for NJ Spotlight News provided by the members of the New Jersey Education Association. Making public schools great for every child. RWJ Barnabas Health. Let's be healthy together. And New Jersey Realtors, the voice of real estate in New Jersey. More information is online at njrealtor.com.
Tonight on NJ Spotlight News, hundreds of student activists from Columbia University were removed and arrested last night after the NYPD stormed its campus. But pro-Palestine protests continue, including one just outside Rutgers Law School.
This has all been organized on the fly, responding both to the ridiculous police violence that Columbia unleashed on its own students, as well as other institutions have done the same.
Plus, students across the country are calling for their universities to divest from Israel. What do those calls really mean?
Maybe a better call than divestment is maybe to ask universities to invest in Palestine, in the Palestinian territories, for the Palestinians to increase their opportunities.
Also, in a historic shift, the DEA is inching toward reclassifying cannabis as a less dangerous drug. What could it mean here in a state where it's already legal?
It's going to begin to lessen the stigma of cannabis as the federal government begins to loosen its restrictions on it.
And hundreds line up to pay their final respects to Donald Payne Jr. as he lies in state here in Newark. NJ Spotlight News begins right now.
From NJPBS Studios, this is NJ Spotlight News with Brianna Venosi.
Good evening and thanks for joining us this Wednesday night. I'm Brianna Venosi. The pro-Palestinian movement that began at Columbia University ended in dramatic fashion Tuesday night after the Ivy League school called in the NYPD to clear out anti-war protesters who've been demonstrating for the last 2 weeks. Police showed up en masse using riot shields and armored vehicles to disperse students from a tent encampment on campus, then climbing a ladder truck into the second-story window of Hamilton Hall to remove a group who had broken in and occupied it the night before. Students were ordered to stay inside their dorms and buildings or risk being arrested. When all was said and done, more than 100 were taken into custody from the school. Columbia's president today said she regretted involving police, but felt she had no choice to keep the community safe. While those on the ground described it as a disturbing 24 hours that mirrored the violent end to similar protests back in 1968. Campuses across the country are on edge, with demonstrators calling for an end to the war in Gaza, where more than 34,000 Palestinians have been killed, and demanding their universities divest and cut ties with Israel. Here in New Jersey, encampments have been set up at Princeton and Rutgers, New Brunswick, but protesters were on the move today, taking their demands to Rutgers Law School in Newark. Ted Goldberg has the story.
Rutgers Newark is the latest school to see protesters camp out.
We will not stop, we will not rest, this closed, divest!
Students, professors, and Newark residents are pitching tents and getting ready to stay over until...
As long as, till our demands are met. We are here until all of the Rutgers demands are met.
Those demands are similar to those from other campus encampments, which include Rutgers divesting from companies associating with Israel. The people who set up shop outside the Rutgers Law School say they came here for a few different reasons.
We have been trying to stand in solidarity with New Brunswick, Rutgers New Brunswick, who is demanding divestment from Rutgers University.
I think the biggest inspiration is coming from the ongoing genocide that's happening to the Palestinian folks and how the communities that we live in, how Rutgers, how Newark, is consistently not talking about it.
Another inspiration comes from across the Hudson. NYPD officers arrested more than 100 people at Columbia University yesterday while clearing a building occupied by protesters. People in Newark don't imagine their protest will become that violent, and they certainly hope it doesn't.
This has all been organized on the fly, responding both to the ridiculous police violence that Columbia unleashed on its own students, as well as other institutions have done the same. We're here in solidarity with the encampment in New Brunswick.
At the simplest, rallies that people have hosted, 70 cops are showing up for, a handful of people. This is not a city where this is not a country that people can protest and not have a fear of police. What's happening in Kabylia is disgraceful and disgusting, and shame on the people that called the police.
Students, when they are repressed, they come back 10 times stronger. The voices are amplified. People feel even stronger about the fact that they are being pushed down simply for their support of Palestinian people and their liberation.
The folks here have many of the same demands as the people camping out in New Brunswick, with a few extra demands specific to Newark, including that Rutgers must offer free tuition and forgive all outstanding student loan debt for people who live in Newark.
We're also asking Rutgers to supply land and buildings for a community land trust that'll provide public housing, something that, you know, has been an issue here in Newark, as Rutgers has been one of the drivers of downtown gentrification. So, you know, we're trying to combine those demands of social justice for Palestine as well as social justice for Newark.
When talking about demands, you can't just ask Rutgers, who is taking from the community of Newark, to answer demands and not hold the Newark city responsible. And so in terms of the demands, again, talking about over-policing, talking about schools, talking about education, a lot of our demands are very important. Houselessness and like house insecurity is a big issue in Newark, and we have Rutgers owning businesses and we have Rutgers owning buildings.
The police in Newark today watched the protesters but didn't make any arrests, and there weren't any serious confrontations. In Newark, I'm Ted Goldberg, NJ Spotlight News.
Demands among protesters vary at each university, but nearly all have called for some form of divestment from Israel. The movement started with Palestinian activists inspired by international sanctions put on South Africa. That helped bring about the end of apartheid. And while divestment has a long history, the practicality of doing it is complicated for higher ed institutions. Donnie Bahar is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and an associate professor at Brown University, whose corporate board just yesterday agreed to meet with student protesters and vote on their divestment proposal. He joins me now to explain why universities are so opposed to the demand. Donnie Bahar, thank you so much for joining me. A really complicated conversation to have. As we know, Brown is going to vote in October on whether to divest. How feasible is this, and how difficult is it for a college to move its investments into funds that are, I suppose, morally and socially responsible?
Well, you know, nobody really knows the exact portfolio that universities have. And I'm not sure that the protesters are asking for such a wide definition in terms of investment, of divestment, because they're not talking about any other conflict in the world, and there are plenty of them. And, you know, that there's many firms act in many countries, like there's a lot of activity with China. They're not talking about that. So I think they're particularly focused on the case of Israel. And there, I think I want to claim that it's feasible in the sense that there's really nothing to divest from. And I think these students, protesters, are overestimating significantly the amount of investment that universities have in Israel. And I think when they open the books, if they're allowed to open the books, they're going to be quite disappointed, because there's really nothing much to divest from, because it's a very small economy with very few firms actually in the stock market. And I can't expand on this, but I think they're going to be quite disappointed, actually.
Yeah, I mean, some of the calls that we've heard anyway, being on the ground at demonstrations, particularly surround, you know, defense funds, funding of weapons and military funding and the like. You're saying, though, that there's not all that much to invest in Israel in order for these schools to pull out?
Right. Look, I mean, I think we can think of different buckets. And, you know, I don't think the protesters have done the due diligence of explaining exactly what do they mean by that. And maybe they will. But if they're talking about direct investments in publicly traded firms in Israel of any industry, there's about 120 firms that are listed in all of the U.S. Stock market exchanges that are Israeli, out of about 9,000 securities. That's a very, very, very tiny amount. And I would be, frankly, very surprised if any of those firms show up in any of the portfolios of these universities, or for what it's worth, for any portfolio of the average American. So there, I don't think that there's going to be a lot of space. There's not going to be big surprises. If they're talking in a very, maybe kind of a second bucket, a much broader definition of divesting from any firm that has any activity in Israel, I mean, I think that that's really an over-the-top request. You know, Israel is the Israeli economy is quite integrated in the world, not only with the U.S., also with Europe. By the way, Europe is not the U.S., but Europe is the main trading mm-hmm. partner of Israel. And you know, if we're thinking about the Googles of the world and Meta and Amazon, that most of them have like a foreign R&D center in Israel. There are about 300 foreign R&D centers in Israel. A lot of these firms invest in Israel to get, you know, to benefit from the innovation that happens in the country of what it's called the startup nation. Maybe a better call than divestment is maybe to ask universities to invest in Palestine, in the Palestinian territories, for the Palestinians to increase their opportunities. And I think that that's a very lovable goal, and I don't see anybody speaking about that. So if we really want to move towards finding a solution, I think the answer is to invest, not to divest.
Mm. Dani Bahar is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institute. He's also an associate professor at Brown University. Thank you so much for adding some context to this.
Thanks for having me.
Meanwhile, lawmakers and watchdog advocates are still grappling with another issue here in the state, proposed reforms to the Open Public Records Act, or OPRA. It's largely used by journalists and the public to get access to government records that have uncovered some of the state's biggest corruption stories. Well, last night, a panel of experts gathered to dissect the suggested changes they say would gut the law as we know it. Senior political correspondent David Cruz reports.
Legislative leaders say the general public cares more about property taxes and other so-called pocketbook issues than they do about the Open Public Records Act. It's you people in the media, they say, who are stirring things up. It's true, a lot of the backlash that led to the failure of the initial attempt at an OPRA update in March did come from press groups like the Society of Professional Journalists. Last night, the group held a forum on the campus of Rider University intended to keep the pressure on lawmakers who pulled the OPRA bill for further consultation with stakeholders and perhaps some amendments.
I want to just caution people, it isn't dead. They're still working on it. They've made that clear. I did district office visits this week, and you know, the responses are that lawmakers, other than leadership, haven't seen any amendments, but that they are indeed working on them, and that, you know, probably within the next 2 weeks, we'll see some hearings drop.
One of the sponsors, the new sponsors, is Tony Bucco, the Senate Republican leader. And that's ominous because if the Democratic caucuses don't have enough votes and the Republicans can lend some votes, then that indicates that they could pass it anyway.
Bucco has been more outspoken on the OPRA bill and, along with Senate Budget Committee Chairman Paul Sarlo, has cited public safety, in addition to an economic burden on municipalities, as a reason for OPRA reform.
You know, those folks that are out there sending in OPRA requests for body-worn camera videos of young women and then posting them on the internet, trying to get at those bad actors to stop that.
Some folks, quite frankly, and I, for a lack of better words, have made some really creepy requests of municipalities and cities around the state of New Jersey, quite frankly.
But requests like that, and it should be noted that lawmakers have presented no actual evidence of them, would be rejected by the current OPRA law, says C.J. Griffin, an attorney who represents media organizations and others who've had their OPRA requests rejected. She's become one of the faces of the resistance to OPRA changes and a target of criticism from bill sponsors. Limiting access to body cams, she says, would just make uncovering corruption and misconduct harder.
Body cams that showed cops bragging on tape about police brutality, committing police brutality. We got a body cam showing the police planted a gun in a field. We got the body cam showing that the police found a flask in the council vice president's car during an accident investigation and tried to hide it from the camera.
Not only is the information world going to sort of explode, the misinformation world is also going to explode. So people have to have confidence in the ability of citizens to get information, and they have to have confidence in the ability of journalists to get information. So this isn't, it's not a trivial matter in any way, shape, or form.
There is still no date set for a new hearing on Oprah. Lawmakers won't say what stakeholders they're meeting with or what they're saying to one another, either in emails or voice messages or texts. And they won't have to. They're immune to the very Oprah law they say they're trying to make better for you. I'm David Cruz, NJ Spotlight News.
In a stunning move, the Biden administration is considering reclassifying marijuana as a less dangerous drug, easing restrictions nationwide, putting it in a category that includes steroids and Tylenol with codeine. The move could be an incentive for Congress to deal with cannabis reform. Today, U.S. Senator Cory Booker, who's long pushed to declassify marijuana, joined other high-ranking members of Congress, introducing the Cannabis Administration and Opportunity Act to push the country even further by decriminalizing cannabis at the federal level. As Melissa Rose Cooper reports, the effects of either change would be historic, even in places like New Jersey, where cannabis is already legal.
I think it would be an important and historic step. The largest and most impactful piece of federal cannabis reform in history.
Adam Goer is senior vice president of the cannabis company, which has two dispensaries in New Jersey, reacting to reports that marijuana could soon be classified as a less dangerous drug on the federal level. According to the Associated Press, the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration wants to move it from a Schedule 1 listing, which includes substances like LSD and heroin, to a lesser level, reclassifying it as a Schedule 3 drug.
Number one, it's going to begin to lessen the stigma of cannabis as the federal government begins to loosen its restrictions on it. Number two, it's going to open up research, lots of new pathways for cannabis to be studied by researchers to find out more about it. I think all Americans, no matter how you feel about cannabis, could agree that that's a positive.
The move would also give cannabis operators a financial boost.
Because there is a tax code called 280E, which basically means that cannabis industries, because they're federally illegal, cannot take normal business deductions. So they've been laboring under really kind of a heavy tax rate since they've started. So by removing 280E, which actually happens once it gets rescheduled to Schedule 3, then that means that operators will have more income, they'll be able to take deductions, and also it will be a much more viable industry to get investment.
As of right now, the proposed reclassification would only apply to medical marijuana, and cannabis advocates say it wouldn't have much of a positive impact in the Garden State.
We've created a policy in New Jersey to legalize cannabis by ignoring the Schedule 1 status of marijuana in the CSA, and moving it down to Schedule 3 really won't affect our industry in New Jersey very much. And for consumers, it could be an added problem. Schedule 3 drugs are things like ketamine and things that require a prescription. So right now we have an over-the-counter regulated adult use market for cannabis in New Jersey. Schedule 3 doesn't quite fit in with what we already have.
Instead, Chris Goldstein says marijuana needs to be descheduled and completely removed as a controlled substance.
And that would equalize cannabis alongside alcohol and tobacco and really follow in line with how states have already regulated this substance. Keep in mind that millions and millions of Americans, including 3 million voters in New Jersey, have gone to the polls to change our state constitutions and allow retail cannabis, and in most states, allow home growing. So keeping marijuana within the Controlled Substances Act, really within any schedule, doesn't make sense any longer.
Jeff Brown, executive director of the Cannabis Regulatory Commission, releasing a statement saying, "If or when the announcement comes from the Drug Enforcement Administration, we look forward to facilitating conversations with cannabis business operators and consumers in New Jersey." Advocates say any move to reclassify marijuana would still have to be reviewed by the Attorney General and allow a period for public comment, which could take months. For NJ Spotlight News, I'm Melissa Rose Cooper.
Support for the Medical Report is provided by Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey, an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
In our Spotlight on Business report, students aren't the only ones protesting on this May Day. Labor organizations rallied in Newark today, demanding better unemployment protections for roughly 700,000 unemployed workers in New Jersey. It comes after a report earlier this month found those workers are left out of the state's unemployment insurance system, with immigrants, low-income workers, and people of color most affected. Senior correspondent Joanna Gagas reports.
Thousands and thousands lack the resources needed to effectively recover from loss of employment.
Nearly a dozen workers' organizations gathered in Military Park in Newark today to commemorate International Workers' Day and to use the moment to propose a new plan for New Jersey's most vulnerable workers called the New Jersey Job Bridge Program.
We here celebrating May Day, the day International Workers' Day, but also we are here demanding a safety net for all excluded workers in New Jersey.
Their movement was launched by a recent report from the Center for Popular Democracy that showed more than 700,000 workers are excluded from the state's unemployment benefits program.
New Jersey is at the forefront of what an unemployment insurance system should look like across the country. But there are still a lot of workers who are not receiving unemployment benefits, either because they're ineligible or they are having trouble accessing those benefits.
That means extending the safety net to independent contractors, to gig workers, to workers without an immigration status, to students that are seeking work right now, to formerly incarcerated people as they rejoin the workforce, the self-employed, and the caregivers. That's what we're here today. We are here to say, pass the Job Bridge Program.
Folks like Marlene, who says she's paid into the unemployment fund for years, but couldn't access the benefits when she needed them.
I'm considered an essential worker. I work in a natural products factory for over 20 years, and due to health issues, I had to resign, and I wasn't able to get any support at all.
The state's Department of Labor has pointed to the high marks New Jersey received in that report and the efforts they're still making to reach those left out.
One of the drivers of this department is to provide equitable access. And we work hard to reach some of the most vulnerable populations. Our work through the community partners is doing a lot of that in reaching workers and ensuring that eligible workers are receiving benefits.
As legislators finalize this year's budget, this group is asking them to fund this program, maybe by taxing massive corporations that have benefited the most from low-wage workers.
New Jersey has a large warehousing and logistics industry that benefits a lot from working class freelancers and gig workers. They are able to pay much lower wages because of the fact that those workers are currently excluded from unemployment benefits. We're thinking about other industries that really thrive on trying to keep wages low and benefits low.
There's a lot of exploitation when it comes to undocumented workers. Here in Jersey, the Department of Labor is very active in the recent past in combating that exploitation. They see a lot of wage theft, failure to pay wages.
John Marino is with the Painters Union and says even if it's a controversial idea, undocumented workers should be protected by unemployment benefits.
Our union supports workers regardless of their status. And we're backing the Job Bridge program because it doesn't leave any worker behind. All workers are entitled to a safe and dignified workplace.
So this May Day marks the first of the month and the first day of what's sure to be a long fight ahead for these workers' groups to bring this program to reality. In Newark, I'm Joanna Gagas, NJ Spotlight News.
On Wall Street, stocks were mixed today after the Fed left interest rates unchanged and reiterated plans to hold them steady. Here's how the markets closed. And finally tonight, family, friends, and members of the public honored the life of Congressman Donald Payne Jr., paying their final respects today as he lies in state at the Essex County Historical Courthouse in Newark. The 65-year-old died last week after being hospitalized following a cardiac episode. Payne Jr. represented New Jersey's 10th congressional district since 2012, succeeding his father, who also died in office. Payne Jr. dedicated his life to public service, having served as a Newark City Councilman and Essex County Commissioner before being elected to Congress. Governor Murphy ordered U.S. and state flags to fly at half-staff today and tomorrow. That's when funeral services will be held at the Cathedral Basilica of the Sacred Heart in Newark. May he rest in peace. And that does it for us tonight. But make sure you tune in to Chatbox with David Cruz tomorrow night. After talking last week to the three Democratic candidates looking to replace Senator Bob Menendez, David goes one-on-one with Republican candidate Curtis Bushall. Watch it Thursday at 6 p.m. on the NJ Spotlight News YouTube channel. I'm Brianna Venosi. For the entire NJ Spotlight News team, thanks for being with us. Have a great evening. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
NJM Insurance Group, serving the insurance needs of residents and businesses for more than 100 years. Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey, an independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. New Jersey Realtors, the voice of real estate in New Jersey. More information is online at njrealtor.com. And by the PSCG Foundation.
I'm Gloria Monks, 2024 president of New Jersey Realtors. Whether it's guiding first-time buyers through the home buying process or securing space for small business owners, New Jersey Realtors have been helping their clients through real estate transactions for more than a century. No matter what your unique needs are, there is a knowledgeable New Jersey Realtor for you. Learn more at njrealtor.com/find.